So I live on a lake that's 7 minutes from the airport here. So our main thing is to fly over to that lake or a lake like it. We take our friends with us, and you can climb up on the wing and jump in there. People can party in the back. Obviously, we can't do that in the front. We just have fun with it and do air shows. That's all we do.
G'day and welcome everyone to episode number 16 of On The Step with That Mallard Guy. As always, I'm your host, Dan Bolton. For those of you joining for the first time, you have just joined the world's most popular float plane and flying boat podcast. So I say welcome to you all, and thanks for getting your feet wet with the rest of us. If you'd like to say hi, please get in contact with me via email on thatmallardguy@hotmail.com or on my Instagram at thatmallardguy. For those regular listeners, please welcome our new friends and act as a role model by showing them how to share this podcast to friends and how to review the show on Apple Podcast. Speaking of which, a quick shout out to Jamalosaurus from Australia, who titles his review Epic Aviation Podcast and says, "Non-pilot here, but with a great passion for aviation. Absolutely love the podcast and the amazing stories we get to hear. It's a good mix of aviation stories, engineering, and even drops of business. Love it." Thanks, Jamalosaurus, for the great review, mate. Folks, at times on this show, we dream with our guests about what would be a great private seaplane to own. Everyone has their own idea, but I must say, the guests I have on today probably have one of the best private machines one could imagine. Over 70 years old, with a payload of over 3 tons, the ability to fly for over 17 hours straight, and powered by over 2,800 horses from its 2 9-engine radials. Oh, don't forget the ability to land on land or water, take 10 of your mates in the back, and jump off the wing into your favorite part of the Bahamas. That's right, folks, we are talking about the Grumman Albatross. It's time to climb into the cockpit. With a shout of clear prop, we'll turn over the right cyclone engines, and once the oil pressures are in the green, we'll look back to the passengers to confirm the beers have been served, and then we'll get going on the step.
Right engine is turning. 12% fuel. A light.
Righty, all the way from Conroe, Texas. Welcome, Michael Barksdale, to On The Step, mate. How are you going?
Hey, good, Dan. How about yourself?
Yeah, very good, mate. A little bit early and not as warm over there in Texas at the moment, mate. How's things?
They're good. We've been working on the Albatross for the past 4 days. It's about 32 degrees. So inside the airplane is probably 40 degrees.
Yeah, right. Does it ever get cold in Texas?
It does. It gets not very cold. Probably gets down to about 10 in Celsius.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. Is that during the daytime or is that just overnight temps?
No, that would be in the wintertime.
Yeah,
or
right.
Winter.
Okay.
So we're just coming into the heat now. It gets pretty warm. It gets up 35 or better in the summer here.
Absolutely. Now, mate, you've just kind of given away why we've got you on the line there today. You are the co-owner of a private Grumman Albatross. Mate, is it the perfect private machine to own?
I'll tell you, it's just a thing of beauty. We love it. So my partner is not a pilot. He's an oil man. And so there's another pilot that flies it with me. And we just have it for fun. We do air shows and put it in the lake right here and just enjoy it with our friends.
Absolutely, mate. There's like so many guys that I speak to when we kind of talk about what would be the dream kind of private machine, so many people say it would be the Albatross, and being able to take it on long journeys and almost have it set out as some sort of flying caravan. Is that the way yours is set out, or is it more in the kind of seating kind of capacity like you would normally expect like an Albatross to be in?
Well, these are military aircraft used for search and rescue originally by 3 different branches of the military here in the U.S. and then a lot of different military around the world. All of them were eventually put in the desert because their mission was complete. They invented long-range helicopters, so they put these in the desert. So we think about maybe 15 or more were taken out of the desert and rebuilt. This is one of them. And so the idea of having this as the dream vacation machine is definitely the right idea. You can outfit it. Some people have it with kitchens and a bar and the leather couches, etc. It's so big that it will carry all of that equipment, and you still have plenty of room to move around, kind of like a drive away. But ours is not.
Okay.
We still have it in the military version. It's pretty basic, but people like that, and it works for us.
Yeah, right. So, like, how many people can you take in this in your own airplane?
The way we have it configured right now, it's for 10. We have two pilot seats. It's a required two-man crew.
Yep.
And then there's two jump seats behind that, and then we have six in the cabin.
Yeah, righto. It's an interesting aircraft. Hey, like we've been looking into it a little bit more in the last kind of couple of months here at Paspaley, and I can't believe that it's so big that it does have two jump seats in the cockpit. That's very unique.
It is. It's a big machine.
Absolutely.
About in pounds, it's about 32,500. That's our gross weight.
Yeah, that's insane.
We can carry 7 hours worth of fuel, so you can really go far if you need to. Why anybody would want to sit in an Albatross for 17 hours is beyond me.
I have to agree with that.
We've done some relief work. I think the longest leg we've had is like 10 or 11 hours, and that was, you just want to get out.
Yeah. We're going to touch on that relief work later on as well, mate. Can you take a step back there and maybe talk a little bit about the history of the Albatross as best as what you know?
Yeah, sure. So it's a U.S. airplane that's made by Grumman. And Grumman makes an airplane that is indestructible. So the PBY was used in World War II. So this is the next generation of search and rescue aircraft. So its purpose was to rescue mostly downed flyers and anybody else that need to be rescued at sea. So it's got lots of ports, et cetera, where you can either tie up or throw out an anchor or find a downed seaman. And they were used extensively in Vietnam. Before that, a little bit in Korea. They started designing in the late 40s. It was built in the 50s. The one we have is 1954. It was built, this was a Navy aircraft that we have. The Air Force had the most because they had the most downed flyers. Then when they invented the long-range helicopter, that kind of took over the mission. So slowly they were parked. And by the mid-70s, all of them were parked in the U.S. except for one. By parked, I mean taken to the desert to rot. And then fortunately, there were some dedicated people that didn't want to see that, so they went down and started putting them back together using available parts, which was difficult. But we think there's about probably 15 flying around the world now, or at least 15 that could fly. Ours is one of the few that you could just get in and fly.
And you talked about them being parked up in the desert there. Are you able to go and access those aircraft for parts for your aircraft?
Yeah, there's a process for that, and that could be done. However, today, all of them have been stripped of any useful parts. So there's still a few carcasses left in the desert, but nothing that anybody could use. As you can imagine, it's a very small community. So we know most of the other owners around the country. And so we kind of trade out parts if we can when we're looking for something. We have five shipping containers of parts down at a little ranch south of here, including ailerons and rudders and control panels and all kinds of mechanisms. So we just trade with the people we need to trade with.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember, I think with Paspaley, when Chalks finally finished up, I think they ended up getting a couple of shipping containers worth of parts and whatnot, but I think that those parts may have already run out by now. But it's pretty common to try and hoard those Grumman parts, especially for those old flying boats.
Yeah, there's still a few places around. So since you brought up Chalks, there's three generations of the HU-16, the Albatross. So it was originally built as an HU-16, which is what we have. And then somewhere in the 60s, they decided they could extend the wing. So some of them were brought back in, and they put a section in the wing to extend it. Unfortunately, the technology they used back then didn't account for the corrosion factor. So all of that's called the long wing, all of those had, they had a time life on them, and all of them have run out of time. So there's only one that we know that still flies. It's a long wing. And then Chalks, that's a G-111, which is a derivative of the HU-16. It was actually a domestic. It wasn't military. and those were built specifically to haul people. Those were also all put in the desert, and then a friend of ours, a guy named Mike, has brought seven of them out of the desert, and he has those at his ranch in Alabama.
Yeah, right. It's interesting, isn't it, talking about that? Like, I guess I didn't realize until looking at it myself recently, you know, they were just built as a military aircraft to start with, and then it wasn't until the 80s that the G111 or G111 came along and was actually made for the civilian market.
Because of the way the U.S. certification process works, it depends on whether you have the military version or the civilian version as to what you can do with them and how you work on them and all that stuff.
Yeah, so things were designed on that aircraft to make it certifiable, wasn't it, for the bigger aircraft there? Because it is such a large aircraft and it's got to fit into those new certifications.
That's true, yep. Yeah, it requires a type rating, and then we have something, I'm not sure if that translates for you, we have something called op specs, which is specific to this airplane where there's certain things that we can do. It's not generic. It's almost like owning an airliner.
Okay, what does op specs mean?
It's operation specifications. It's a document that you document. It's 300 pages long that you have approved by the FAA, and they allow you to. It spells out very specifically about how you train on it, how you work on it, all the record keeping. So we can't just use a document to keep our records. We have to use the FAA approved document. That wouldn't be true of our neighbor if he had a HU-16. He'd have to have his own op spec that were approved by a different branch of the FAA.
Okay, yeah, interesting. Now, mate, you spoke about the two crew thing. How does that go when you try and get your own private machine, and then you've got to employ another pilot or have another guy who's involved? Like you said, your business partner's not a pilot at all, to be able to get the thing in the air. Does that throw a few spanners in the works every now and again?
As you can imagine, it does. The technical part of it is that because of the size of the airplane, you have to have a type rating in the airplane. And then, of course, you have to have a multi-engine C rating if you want to land it in the water. So it takes a multi-engine land rating and a multi-engine C rating to fly the airplane. And then on top of that, type rating for the HU-16. So the left seat guy has to be typed in the airplane and also have all the qualifications. The guy in the right seat has to have the specific qualifications, but not the type rating. So if you're only going to operate on land, as long as he's multi-engine land, that's good, or multi-engine C if you're going to be in the water. But the caveat to all this is I'm an instructor, so somehow you have to be able to teach people. So whoever's sitting in the right seat, I can teach. So it can be anybody that's somewhat qualified.
And who's the lucky fellow who gets to come flying with you all the time in the Albatross?
Actually, I'm the lucky one. I really am. So it's a gentleman named Pat, and he's the third of the trio of us that work on the airplane all the time. And so he's been with the airplane since it came out of the desert. He knows every piece, every part. He's got a huge machine shop down where we keep all this. We call it the Boneyard. That's the name of the section of the ranch where we keep all the parts in the machine shop. And he's just a master. I mean, the airplane would not move without Pat because he can fix anything. He can tell us what's wrong. And on top of that, he's an excellent pilot. So he's the other one that flies with me. But, I mean, even though I own the airplane, we're the same.
Yeah, right. That's great to have one. A guy like that in your back pocket, I guess, to help out all the time.
I wouldn't be able to move the airplane without him.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Now, mate, so this aircraft's name is Zeus. That's what you guys call it. Can you give us a little bit of history about this airplane in particular?
Yeah, this airplane was built for the Coast Guard, of all things, but they didn't take delivery of it, so the U.S. Navy did. So there's just some unique parts of it that are Coast Guard specific that if you didn't know anything about the airplane, you wouldn't realize. But delivery of it was the Navy. It was all over the world. It spent some time in Japan. It spent some time in Iceland. It was, of course, a lot of different places in the U.S., all for search and rescue. In 1965, the U.S. Navy decided they were going to start pulling these airplanes back in and reconstructing them, if you will. So they brought this one back in, put all new skin on it, rebuilt the engines. I mean, it was just like it was a brand new airplane. That was in the summer of 1965. In the spring of 1966, they parked it in the desert.
And then when did you guys actually get it out of the desert then?
Yeah, so the history of it's a little complicated, but I guess technically I'd be third generation on this. There was a good friend of ours, call sign is Tuna, Southwest pilot. So he and his family actually did all the work and brought it out of the desert. It took him 7 years.
Wow.
And it was a major effort, and he spent all of his time doing it. He's a great guy. Then he flew it for a while, just as a private airplane. And then for personal reasons, decided to sell it. So he sold it to my current partner, Stuart, and another man named Mike, who was a Southwest pilot. That's how they knew each other. And so they bought it and flew it for a while. And then, unfortunately, Mike had a heart attack and died.
Oh, no.
So I had been flying the airplane quite a bit for them, but just as a hired gun. I didn't have any ownership in them. It was great. No money, you get to fly the airplane. So I've been with the airplane for a long time. I've only owned it for 4 years.
Okay. And then where does the name Zeus come from?
Yeah, that's Stuart. There were actually two of these. There's another one called Pegasus. And they bought Pegasus first. I'm sorry. They bought Pegasus first. And they had that one. And then Zeus became available from Tuna. So they bought that one too. So they had two of these. And that's when I came into it. There was a gentleman on the East Coast named JB who bought the blue one, Pegasus, moved it to the East Coast. And when we get to it, that's actually the one that we used in 2017 for the hurricane relief. So I flew that quite a bit for them. And then unfortunately, JB had a Navy contract. And 2 summers ago, he was 450 miles off of the coast of the United States on a Navy contract. On takeoff, hit something submerged in the water that sliced a giant hole in the side of the airplane right below the cockpit windows, and the airplane was flooded. Stayed afloat for 5 hours until they were rescued, but then it sank.
Oh, bugger.
So Zeus and Pegasus were the two names that Stuart came up with. That's what he wanted to name these airplanes.
Does he have a bit of a Greek heritage, old Stewie? Or
you would think so, right? No, he's a... I wish he was here. He's a pretty unusual guy. He grew up in the Bahamas on a boat. That was his upbringing. And then went in the Navy when he was 17. So eventually got into oil. He's got some great stories about that.
Because I mentioned the Greek thing, and it's kind of funny that the Greek Navy also used them as well. And I think they were one of the last to use the Albatross in service.
Yeah, probably the Greeks, and there were also some down in South America that were used into the 80s. But, I mean, these things were all over the world.
Yeah, absolutely they were. So, mate, we might as well jump into that relief stuff that you were doing for the hurricane in 2017. Like, tell us a little bit about how you get involved in that kind of work when, I guess, there's, you know, the military and all other aid services available. How does... you know, a little private guy with an albatross get involved in relief work?
Kind of interesting, isn't it? The way it works in the United States, we have an organization called FEMA, which is a governmental organization that normally does disaster relief. And this is Hurricane Maria that was famous for Puerto Rico. I've dealt with the government before in other relief efforts and did not really want to do that again. But just past Puerto Rico, or the U.S. Virgin Islands, St. Thomas, St. Croix, and St. John, and they were devastated. I mean, they were cleaned off of every leaf of every tree. All the houses were gone, not the structure, but the roofs. And so there's a lot of money down there, some very influential people that had vacation homes. And what they wanted to do is turn their homes into some place for the first responders and also for their friends, the natives that lived on the island. So they hired us because nobody could get in there. The waters were contaminated, so nobody could really land in those, and the runways were not very clear. We could land on a taxiway that was adjacent to the runway that we felt was strong enough. And in the very beginning, that's when we come in. We could carry a lot of weight in this, plus the cabin is so long. We can carry huge pieces of lumber, lots of generators, water, tarps, etc. So in the beginning, we overflew Puerto Rico and landed in St. John, and then it was trucked or boated to the other islands. Mostly what we took is lumber to build a roof for these, what used to be fairly expensive houses and tarps so they could cover them and generators and a lot of medicine. And that way they could set up some hospitals and set up some places for their first responders so they had indoors. As you can imagine, as the water is cleared and as the runways are cleared, then you can start getting U.S. military airplanes and FedEx, et cetera. And so when they start, our mission is kind of over. But it was so important because everything was going to Puerto Rico that we actually flew it for about a month.
So it's kind of like, you know, no one can get in those first few days and weeks. You guys kind of jump on it and are able to get in there really quickly.
Yeah, and it was an organization we really weren't familiar with, and so they found us somehow. And then after that, we became known for being able to do that. So when the Bahamas were hit last year, we were all set to go. We got a lot of money and a lot of hospital supplies set up ready to go. Unfortunately, of all things, the airplane was down for the first time ever, and it was a problem that took us about 2 weeks to fix, and at the end of 2 weeks, our mission is over.
How do you prepare for that? Like, it kind of sounds like you need to be on standby almost to get ready for it. Like, are you kind of well aware of the cyclone or the hurricane coming to that area? So you start to raise funds and get some supplies just in case? Or is it just as soon as it hits and you see the devastation, you just jump on it and everything's a go?
Yeah, it's more like the second. We don't have the mission of disaster relief, although I guess we do now, but that was never our intent. We were just trying to help people when they needed help. In order to get ready for these, we learned from Maria in 2017. There's nothing out there. There's no fuel. There's no water. There's no food. No place to stay. So we learned that we need to take bedrolls so we can sleep in the airplane and take our own water. We have, if we put the drop tanks on, which we have but we normally don't use, we have 17 hours worth of fuel. So we can fly from Florida all the way out to St. John's and then get back to something like the Dominican Republic so we can get fuel. But we can stay airborne for a long time, which most people can't do, and still carry a lot of stuff. So the preparation then becomes just making sure that we have enough to take care of us first. And if we can't be taken care of, we can't take care of anybody else. Then after that, just finding the people that have the equipment that needs to go out there, and then we just take care of the logistics. We've now hooked up with an organization here in Houston that calls on us. They're the ones who called on us for Bahamas. And so I guess we are on standby, but once again, that's not our mission, but we're always there to help.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's not the best place by look of the map there to be on standby for hurricane relief in, say, the Virgin Islands or the Bahamas. You guys are Central America. You'd be based in Florida, so that must cause a bit of havoc as well.
Well, just normally we do is fly to Florida and then base ourselves out of Florida. So it's just that first leg getting out there, which takes a day in itself. Then after that, it would just be from Florida out, back and forth. And then every now and then we have to go someplace to put the airplane back together so we can do some more.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what about also like the path of the hurricane? Because I imagine that a lot of them come from the east, don't they? And then kind of finish up almost at Florida. So does that cause an issue as well, trying to get to Florida to start with?
Hurricanes are very unique. So yes. You never know. Each one's going to do something totally different. And they're unpredictable. They make, as you know, sudden turns at the end. So what's expected is not what happens. So you just have to wait. Here in Texas, we get lots of hurricanes. As a matter of fact, we're probably going to get one on Sunday.
All right.
But because it's land-based here, we can just truck, for the most part, we can truck things in unless it's inaccessible.
Is that so they'd be coming through the Gulf of Mexico there, do they? And
that's correct.
And back up. Would you be getting like full Category 5 through that area, or are they kind of a bit not as potent, I guess, because there's not much water?
Well, the last time we had one here was Hurricane Harvey, which was Category 5.
Oh, right.
A couple of years ago. That actually hit Houston. It was not a very good thing. They change. Sometimes they're a Category 3 just off the coast, or 5 by the time they hit it, or the other way around. It's just so unpredictable. But we are right in the center of hurricanes right here.
Yeah, that's crazy. It's obviously great work that you guys do to be able to go out in there and help those communities. I mean, I spoke to a guy, Michael Steers, in episode 8 of my show here, who used to fly mallards around the British Virgin Islands, and he talked regularly about you know, hurricanes destroying some of those islands there. And obviously, you know, that's how the Virgin Islands seaplane shuttle ended up falling to parts, was a hurricane. So those right. areas obviously very susceptible to that disaster. But it's great to hear that you guys are helping out. And I think I also spoke to Rob at Flytropic, who also did a bit of relief work in the Bahamas. I think that was for the one in 2019 that you were talking about. So
right, and that's who we were going to. That's who we were associated with, and that's who we should have flown for.
Yeah,
they were going to let us stage there because there's a lot going on when saltwater landings, et cetera. You have to be washed down with special treatments, et cetera. So
absolutely,
they had all the equipment for that.
So were you going to be based out of the old Miami seaplane base there?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
We prefer to be on land, so we'd be on the land, but we'd be using their facilities, and they were their dispatch facilities, et cetera. Dealing with you're always dealing with the international waters and the different governments, so the paperwork itself can be very difficult.
That's always holding aviation up, isn't it? The paperwork.
Yeah, generally, and the government.
Yep.
Yeah,
mate. What about, so you spoke about how that's not your type of mission flying. Now you spoke about also prior to that you do a bit of air show work. Can you tell us a little bit about how that works? Like how far are you taking the airplane and what are the kind of things that you're doing at air shows?
Prior to COVID, there's a lot of air shows in the United States, a lot.
Absolutely, yeah.
And fortunately, there's a lot right here in Texas or in the adjacent states like Louisiana, Oklahoma, et cetera. This airplane's a 150-knot airplane, so we're not going to fly far away if we don't have to. It's also very expensive. It's about $600 an hour just for the fuel. We figure about $2,600 an hour for the general operation.
Wow.
So air shows, we can go to enough air shows here. We could go to one every week or every other week and just stay within 500 miles of where we are. The airplane is so unique that we're always asked to be at air shows. And I was one of the stars. So we just take the airplane to an air show. We set up a little easel, ask for some donations if people want to help us out, give tours. Sometimes we fly, but most of the time it's just a static display.
Is Oshkosh on the radar every year?
It could be. It was on the radar this year until they canceled it. We were dealing with them.
Yeah.
It's a long ways up there and kind of expensive to get there. So if they're willing to help us out, we were on the way, but prior to ever reaching a deal, then, of course, they had to cancel it.
Yeah, right.
But we went to Sun and Fun a couple of years ago. That was probably 4 or 5 years ago. They always have quite a few amphibians down there.
That's out in the desert or something, isn't it? Or in a salt bed or something?
No. Sun and Fun is in Lakeland, Florida, which is sort of by Orlando over that way.
Okay.
It's on the west coast of Florida. Reno Air Races, maybe?
No, I think there's one I see where they kind of all land on a lake bed there somewhere. I mean, like you said, mate, there's so many air shows in America. How do you keep up? It's bloody ridiculous.
Yeah, so that might be Mojave.
Maybe, yeah. I'll have to look at that.
We have something called the International Council of Air Shows, and every December we meet in Las Vegas for 4 days, and it's every air show is there, every act, including the Blue Angels, Thunderbirds, I mean, everybody. And then it's like Tetris, if you know what Tetris is. You just have to figure out how we can fit all the air shows, what weekend we can be there. Because if you're somebody like us or some of the T6 groups, et cetera, you can't do an air show on the East Coast in one time, then Chicago the next week, and then California the next. So you kind of have to make it work for you.
No, that's fair enough. And then, so what other mission work do you have for the airplane other than kind of air shows and a bit of relief? Is there any time to jump in it yourself and, you know, maybe take it out to the Virgin Islands there and have a bit of a holiday in the plane?
Yeah, there is, Dan. And just to be fair, the reason we have this airplane is to have fun. That's the reason we have the airplane. This whole relief thing came as an add-on to it. We love to do it. We'll continue to do it. But that really isn't why we have it. So I live on a lake that's 7 minutes from the airport here. So our main thing is to fly over to that lake or a lake like it. We take our friends with us, and you can climb up on the wing and jump in there. People can party in the back. Obviously, we can't do that in the front. We just have fun with it and do air shows. That's all we do.
That sounds pretty good to me, mate.
I'll tell you what, it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely. Count me in when I come over there to visit.
Yeah, the Jimmy Buffett lifestyle.
Yeah, right. Have you met Jimmy?
I've never met him. I've talked to him on the phone. And of course, he used to own one called Hemisphere Dancers. Hemispheres Dancers, yeah. And then he decided to park it. It's in front of his restaurant in Orlando. But he's just built a margarita villa, just is in the process, 5 minutes from my house on the lake. And so I've been talking to them. They're going to open here in about 3 weeks about using the airplane as a display, because we make a lot of noise and a lot of smoke and splash a lot of water. So we want to be out there for his opening weekend.
That sounds pretty cool.
It is.
Yeah, obviously, Jimmy, if you're listening, mate, I'm sure you are.
I'm sure he is. He listens all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Mate, we want to get Jimmy on the show too. I've tried to put the feelers out a little bit, so it'd be pretty cool to get him on and talk a little bit about the Albatross from his perspective. But we'll try and get him on. I'll keep working my hardest to try and get him on, but I'm not sure how it's going to go.
Yeah, I would if I were you, Dan.
He's a busy man, I think, Jimmy. He's on tour at the moment, I believe.
I believe so. He was supposed to be here in Houston a couple of weeks ago. I always go see him every time I can. It's just the strangest group of people, and I love it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I read something on Wikipedia, and this kind of touches back a little bit about what you're talking about going and splashing down and having fun, that something like every year there's a bit of a fly around or fly in of albatross owners, that, and that's where you can kind of organize to get some type ratings done. Is that still happening, or was that something that was happening in the past?
There have been some in the past. Unfortunately, there aren't enough left anymore that people get together. We used to do one here in Conroe. We did for years and years. R. Zeus and then Pegasus, the one that sunk. And then there's a gentleman out in Big Spring, Texas, a very wealthy man named Connie Edwards, who was a good friend of ours. You should Google that name. Nobody's ever heard of him, but he's pretty amazing.
Connie Edwards, was it?
Yes, Connie Edwards. You'll be amazed when you Google it. But he had the only one that was ever released from the military that wasn't parked in the desert. It belonged to the Coast Guard commander. And so they allowed Connie, because of his government connections, to just take it as is. So it still had all the navigation equipment, all the radios with the tubes in them and all that stuff. So we used to gather here in Conroe every November, because you have to have annual training on it. And we'd all gather down here and bring in an examiner. And then, of course, trade stories and trade parts, and the examiner would get us all recurrent again. Unfortunately, Pegasus sank, and Connie died, so it's just us now.
I just found the part that I was talking about. So it says on Wikipedia, the trusted source, Wikipedia, obviously, there is a yearly albatross flying at Boulder City, Nevada, where albatross pilots can become type-rated.
Yeah, I'm not too sure they're still doing that. I haven't heard about that for about a couple of years.
Yeah, right. I wouldn't have thought so.
Well, I mean, that was a big albatross central point for quite a while.
Okay.
I'd have to investigate that.
Yeah, right. And you talked about some of the training you can do. Are you able to now typewrite and check out pilots on a yearly basis yourself? Or you said you had to get an FAA examiner in as well?
Yes. So we can do all the training, but the training and the checking can't be done by the same person. And in the U.S., it's called an NDEPR, N-D-P-E-R. And it's just a person that's specifically trained to give ratings in military aircraft, military-style aircraft.
All right.
So it's a unique thing. The gentleman we use has been doing it for 100 years. He's flown everything. He used to be Connie Edwards' pilot, as a matter of fact. And he knows everything. So it's not only check rides, but it's also just a wealth of information, because he can pass on all the things that he's learned over the years.
Yeah, there's not many of those guys left in the industry, is there, that just have that wealth of knowledge and can pass it
on? No, and unfortunately, he's getting up in years like we all are, and when we lose people like that, there's just no replacements.
Yeah. Mate, I just did a bit of Googling on Connie Edwards there, so he's had hangars full of military aircraft, hey?
Yeah, we could do a whole show on Connie Edwards if you want to do that later. He's just real interesting.
Sure.
There was a movie in 69, I think it was, called The Battle of Britain. He flew most of the airplanes for that. And then after the movie was over, he brought the airplanes back. So he had ME 109s and a whole bunch of P-51s. He had P-40s, he had PBYs, and just hangars full, and Quonset huts full of unused Merlin engines. And I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, how did he take possession of all that?
Yeah, well, that'd be the next story.
Yeah, right.
he was a real character. Let me tell you, there's nobody like him. There's an interview with him probably 15 years ago or so. If you can find that, you can kind of get an idea of. He was just one of those last great Texans.
I think actually looking at, because I see one, it looks like the interview you're talking about with the Tales of the Flying Turtle, which is with with a PBY. I might have actually seen that before. Now I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, he decided to start selling his airplanes, I guess that would be in 2014. So he sold a couple of P-51s. So that kind of popped him up on the radar for a lot of people after that.
Yeah, right.
But we got to know him. We actually met him in, I think the first time was in Sun and Fun, as a matter of fact, when he was down there. So another part of this is a part of our mission, since you asked what it is. We have a charitable organization that we operate for the education of especially young people about naval aviation and how it ever got to be, and how the flying boats especially are what caused naval aviation to be what it is. So in 1919, the first aircraft went across the Atlantic, which is unknown to most people. It was a naval aircraft, U.S. naval aircraft, an NC-4, and there were actually four of them, but only one of them made it across. But that became the official first crossing in the Atlantic. It was on May 8th of 1919. Connie Edwards did the 75th anniversary, and that is documented if you ever want to Google that. That's pretty interesting. And then we were going to do the 100th anniversary. We were working towards that. And that would have been on May 8th of last year. We were supposed to depart New York Harbor and head north and then cross the Atlantic to the Azores and then to Portugal, Spain, and up to England. Unfortunately, I was injured before that, so we couldn't complete the mission.
Oh, bugger. That would have been quite an epic trip.
It would be. Hey, if you're interested, my partner Stuart just showed up.
Yeah, get him on the line. Bring him in.
Not everybody says that, you know.
Hey, Dan. How the heck are you?
G'day, Stuart. Welcome on the line, mate.
Thank you.
My first little drop-in interviewee in middle of an interview. How good. I love it. So, Stuart, you're one of the co-owners of this machine. Is it just as good as what Michael's been saying? Is it the epic, most epic private seaplane to own?
I think it's the most epic aircraft of any type to own. Every air show we go to proves that.
Yeah,
we are our attraction everywhere we go.
And you're not a pilot, so you're in the oil industry, mate. So it must be even better. You can just sit in the back there and have these boys fly you around and kick the leg up, and you can do all the partying, like Michael said, in the back there.
I am in charge of the beers, and I'm serving myself. So it's perfect. It is great.
How did you get into owning the Albatross?
Yes, this goes back quite a number of years. Another Mike was my original partner, and he was a Southwest Airlines captain, so he always wanted to fly an Albatross, and we got to talking about it over scotch and cigars one night and decided it was a great idea, so we bought one, and thought it was such a great idea, we bought another one, so we had two at one point.
And what's your favorite memory of the Albatross? I mean, we've spoken with Michael all about the kind of mission work and the air show stuff that you guys do. Does one story just stand out as one of your most favorite and happiest moments in the Albatross?
Oh, there's so many.
I bet.
The trip to the Bahamas. We rented a big house on the beach down in the Abacos and flew the Albatross down there. And took the whole, couple families, and had a great time, and spent some time flying around the Out Islands. Just absolute gorgeous scenery out there.
Yeah, it's a beautiful spot.
We actually took the Albatross down to the Bahamas before the hurricane. Was that last year?
Well, it was
2 years, whatever. But within the last 2 years, we took it down there and met up with a man on his boat at his island. Pretty scenery.
How do the family love it? Like, is it just must be mind-blowing just being able to take this, 70-year-old aeroplane and just take it to the Bahamas for a week or whatever. That must be so cool.
Yes. They've had a good time. They love getting up on the wings and diving off and laying around in the water. My boys love doing the air shows as well because they get to show everybody around their airplane and show some of the kids the secret compartment up forward, the anchor compartment.
Oh, yeah, through the nose bay there.
Yeah, it always seems to thrill the kids.
I've been dreaming about jumping off the wing of the Mallard, but unfortunately up here in the Northern Territory, we have crocodiles, we have jellyfish that can nearly kill you, and basically sharks. So it's a little bit more riskier, I guess, than jumping into the Bahamas, but unfortunately not yet.
Yeah, my mates in Australia tell me pretty much everything there wants to kill you.
Basically, yeah. I think anyone who comes to Australia, they reckon that our animal life is just like, it's there to kill you. That's what they always say.
The water snakes are the ones that scare the hell out of me. It's saltwater snakes. I'm not used to that.
No, it's a very unique animal they are for sure.
Yeah.
Now, just back, Michael, there, you spoke about the fact that you're in the cabin there before I got you into the air-conditioned office there to do this interview. What kind of maintenance work are you doing at the moment with the COVID stuff, and how much effort goes into maintenance all year round?
It's a year-round project. It's an old airplane, so it takes a lot of care. The main thing is that Stuart and I want to make sure that this airplane is totally safe and 100% operational. So if something doesn't work, we make sure that it's fixed. Getting out of the water, if you're in the water, it takes a tremendous effort. It takes everything this airplane has. So if something would go wrong at that moment, you'd be in a lot of trouble. We want to make sure that it's safe. Well, so we use the winter when there's no air shows and it's kind of cool down here. Nobody wants to go flying in a lake to do most of the major maintenance, especially the preventative maintenance. One of the things we're doing now has been a project a year in the making where we had some corrosion that we needed to fix. But because the hull is so deep, it's down deep in the hull, it just takes somebody that's willing to go down in there and do a lot of riveting, et cetera. So spent quite a few days on that. We've imported some specialists for that. Also, we had some fuel selector valves that need to be changed and just some general maintenance work. But it should be ready to go here and ready for the air show season if that ever starts again shortly.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good. We just actually rehulled one of our Mallards. It was about a 4 or 5 month process. A lot of effort those sheeties put in to re-rivet a whole hull. Obviously being 2.5 times the size of a Mallard, the Albatross hulling effort must be pretty crazy as well.
Well, fortunately, we don't have any corrosion on the aircraft other than this one cross brace. And it wasn't that bad, but it was there. So
it's preventative. We need to fix it.
Well, you guys don't really operate much in Assault. Is it just the kind of Bahamas stuff that you do? Otherwise, it's mostly lake work, yeah?
It is by choice. You know how corrosive salt water can be. And the airplane needs some exterior work, like paint. And so we just try to keep it out of the salt water. I don't know if it's ever been in the salt water.
Not since the Navy.
Yeah, since the Navy. So that's why it's corrosion free.
We've made some very nice low passes, though.
Yeah. Look like we're.
And because you talk about paint, like I'm looking at a picture here on your Facebook there, Michael, and is it just bare skin that's on there, or is it actually like a silver paint that's on the aircraft?
It's sort of like anodized aluminum. So it's not as good as paint, but it's good for the exterior. The problem is the overlap, the seam need to be sealed. Because if they're not sealed, then, as you know, salt water can just seep into them and not really cause any problems for several years. But you can't ever get rid of that corrosion. So it needs to be seam sealed more than it needs to be painted.
Yeah, right. I guess one thing we haven't spoken about the Albatross yet is the engines. So what engines do they actually have, and how do those work? Pretty epic old radials, aren't they?
Epic is a good word. Yeah, they're 1820s. These are -76s, which is a little bit different. It's the same engine on a B-17, same engine on a T-28, a trainer for the U.S.
DC-3s.
Yeah, they're DC-3s had 1820s, and they went to 1830s after that. I think some of the original Hell Divers had some, too. This one's kind of unique, and that all props that move need engine oil to do that. This actually has its own oil system just for the prop. It's called an IOC. So that's a little bit different than any of the other 1820s you're going to see out there. It's a single bank of nine cylinders, and the thing is massive and loud and takes a lot of oil. We've got almost 60 gallons of oil in the airplane.
Wow, that's insane.
Yeah,
I guess when you're flying 17-hour sectors, you probably need a fair bit of oil, don't you?
Well, believe it or not, we've got ours in pretty good shape right now, and it's not using as much oil as most do.
Yeah, the book says it's supposed to burn about a gallon a side per hour.
Per hour.
And we're closer to a half gallon per hour. So the motor's nice and tight.
Yeah.
You sure it's got oil? Don't they say when a radial's not leaking oil, it doesn't have any left?
You're just out of oil. That's right.
Yeah.
You can see the ramp underneath ours. You wouldn't have to worry about that. We got lots of oil.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I remember flying the Beaver. We had the oil filler was in the cockpit there so that you could top up oil during flying. Is that the same for these engines as well, or do you have to get onto the wing for the oil?
Oh, no. That's the storage part. Everything in the Albatross is on top of the wing. The engines are up there, so is the hydraulic system, so is the oil, yeah. So is the fuel, everything. So that steward spends his time when he's not in the cabin up on top of the wing.
Little lackey, Stuart.
Well, they figured it was appropriate because I was in the oil business.
Yeah.
I didn't explain the difference, but they weren't buying it.
So. Are you sponsored by the oil company?
No, unfortunately.
I guess they pay the bills for you, though.
We actually pay their bills.
Yeah, right.
As you know, most people that own these are either foundations or museum or multimillionaires. Stuart and I are kind of multi-thousandaires, so it's a little bit of a...
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Well, you joined together, you might make the million, maybe.
Well, we had it before we bought the Albatross.
Yeah, yes. Clearly in the million category before the Albatross.
Yeah. What do they say in aviation? If you want to make $1 million in aviation, start with 10 or something like that.
You're right, yeah.
Oh, at least you guys are having fun, because I know I just wanted to touch before we get going and at the end of the interview here a bit on your actual career, Michael. How did you get into seaplane flying? Because you basically have a very long airline career.
Yeah, so just briefly, my dad was a pilot captain for United Airlines, and so I had that legacy. My mom was a stewardess back then. So I flew for United for 35 years. And after I retired, I went down to Air New Zealand and worked for them for a while. Now I work for Boeing. I teach the 787 internationally around the world. As part of that, then, you get aviation in your blood. So I've done a lot of civilian flying. And we just happened to be here at the same airport with the original Mike and Stuart. Got to meet them, started flying the airplane. And I really didn't have any seaplane experience before that at all. And then
okay.
I think I already told you the rest of the story. So.
Yeah.
Rather than fly it and have no money in it, now I have both.
Yep.
So I've got about 36,000 hours, I think, something like that.
And you talk about the stuff you're doing at the moment for Boeing. Like, so do you just contract out to airlines to be able to teach the 78 to them, or
yep.
How does that work?
Yeah, that's Boeing that does the contract work. So it's two different kinds. For the most part, if you're a small company like, say, Air Ethiopia, you're not going to have your own simulators and your own training department. So you contract to Boeing to do that work for you in Boeing simulators, and they're all over the world. And then sometimes you contract out to a specific company because they have a big surge in training. They don't want to hire their own people, so they use us. So I've recently been working for ANA in Japan the past couple of years.
Yeah, right. And do you like that kind of work, teaching in the sim compared to the flying that you would have been doing on the 78 before that?
As you can imagine, it's not the same at all. And I miss flying greatly, flying that kind of airplane. But it's still good to be involved. And I was the first one to be trained here in the United States, was part of the team that brought it on board for Continental Airlines at the time. And then when I went down to Air New Zealand, I went down there because they were starting their 78 program. So they asked me to come down and help them start it. So I just ended up with a wealth of knowledge on the 787, so it's good to pass it on to other people.
It's an incredible aircraft, obviously doing really well. And how has your job been affected by COVID, I guess, with the training side of things?
Yeah, like everything else, the airlines have shut down their training. Personally, I was in Japan when all this happened, and then I elected to come home because I was kind of concerned about being trapped in a foreign country in the midst of a crisis. And, of course, everything has been stopped now, and we'll have to wait for things to start again. But in the meantime, I've had an awful lot of time to do the other flying that I do here and fly the Albatross. It's all good.
That's it. Make a positive out of a negative, absolutely.
Except for the income.
Or lack thereof.
Yeah. The Albatross doesn't come up, but my income has kind of fallen off.
Guys, I just had one more other question about the Albatross. And how many hours are you actually doing in the aircraft every year on average?
On average, we're probably I know we're less than 100 hours a year flying, and I think we had a year where I had an injury trying to fall off the Albatross and had to get operated on my arm, and then Mike tore up his knee and had to get operated on. So it was under 50 hours a year.
Definitely that.
Yeah, fair enough. Alrighty, guys. Just before we do finish the question, I like to finish this interview with a little splash and dash questionnaire, I guess, just like the land plane, the touch and go. We're just going to splash on a few questions here and get your favorite answers. I guess outside of the Albatross, is there any other aircraft that you would be an absolute dream seaplane to fly?
I'd like to fly the Mallard. I think that's that's probably one of the best airplanes out there. And get some of the turbo conversions. And, of course, the Mars. Who wouldn't want to fly the Mars?
Yeah, the Mars would be insane.
Yeah. You got to see that in Oshkosh.
On water, did you see it, or just flying over?
No, that was so big that they kept it out in the water at the seaplane base, off the seaplane base. Very impressive.
Oh, mate, I can't offer you a Mars trip, but I can definitely offer you a Mallard trip if you ever come to Australia. So we'll trade on that one for sure.
Great, I'll take you up on that.
What do you think the best looking seaplane is of all time?
Oh, the Albatross.
How could there be another answer to that, Dan?
Exactly.
It's the biggest and baddest. A lot of people like Catalina. It's kind of gangly and it's really slow and it's not good on the water. So
now you got two votes for the Albatross here.
Fair enough. Do you guys have? You don't have that weird looking bubble on the nose for the radar, though, do you?
Of course we do. All airplanes have that.
Snoopy nose.
Come on. Right, okay.
You've probably seen people that have exchanged that for a plexiglass one so you can crawl up in there airborne and see out.
Yeah, right. Which aircraft was used in the movie, The Expendables or something, for that little shot coming out of the nose?
That was an Albatross.
You don't know which aircraft that was?
We met the owners. I forget the tail number on that.
Southern California, and that guy actually was standing out there and did that. The gun wasn't in there. They added that later, but he truly was standing up in that hatch airborne.
Truly was smoking his cigar, hanging his arm out the window.
Yeah, but we do that.
We do
that's
that.
Not a big deal.
Yeah. It's America. You can do whatever you want, can't you?
Yeah, we just fly the windows back and have a good cigar.
Happy days. Have you seen that the flying boat film that they were trying to start up? That was based on an Albatross as well, I believe. And I think there's a shot of them actually being in the front of the nose airborne as well.
Yeah, so
I guess it could be done.
Dirk.
Up in Colorado. Yeah, we know him. He came down here for one of our last fly-ins, as a matter of fact.
He's got a lot of footage of our plane, but it didn't cut because his other aircraft that he got permission to film with had paint, and we didn't. So, I'm actually in there very, very briefly, and the rest of it ended up on the cutting room floor.
He's a good guy. We like Kirk.
Yeah, he seems like a legend. Do you know anything about the flying boat film? Is it coming soon, or hasn't been much talk of it for a while?
Well, the last I heard, he was looking for the final funding to do the full editing and then get it out. And
we're hopeful, but like you, it kind of fell off the radar. We haven't seen it for a while.
Hopefully we can get him on here, get a bit of publicity.
That'd be great.
And then kind of find some funding for it. Maybe Jimmy can get involved.
Yeah.
That'd be cool.
When you get hold of him, mention that to him, would you?
I will. Righto, no worries. mate, a couple of other questions. Piston or turbine seaplane? I mean, you've sounds like you've mainly got experience with piston, but what do you think would be better there, piston or turbine?
Well, as you said, I don't have any experience with turbine engines on the water, so I can't say it as an expert, but I would think that that would be a better deal. They produce a lot more power. They're a lot more reliant. I'm always worried trying to get off the water that everything's going to work until I'm airborne.
Yeah, but right.
I don't know that I'd ever want to see a retrofitted Albatross with it. It'd be like putting a rice rocket engine on a old Harley. Wouldn't sound right. Wouldn't look right.
No, fair enough. And I guess what you guys do, you want the nostalgia of the radials, really, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely. This is not about efficiency.
No. And just kind of touching on that, there was one turbine Albatross made back in the past, wasn't there? It was with a Rolls-Royce Dart engine in there, and it didn't really work out.
I heard it flew once.
Yeah, I'm not even sure that it flew, Dan. It was down in Florida, and what you said, they attempted it, but it just didn't work. The wing is not quite right for it. And as you know, there's several people in the world, including a group in Australia, that are trying to convert the Albatross to turbine engines, and no success yet.
Who knows? Maybe one day it might happen, but it's pretty hard to see that happening.
The G111 would be the better airplane for that.
Built
for that kind of mission.
Well, I guess really the only seaplane, turbine engine seaplanes that are being made at the moment really would be the Twin Otter, obviously on floats, and then I guess the 415 is getting re-energized, I guess, through Viking as well. I guess the Dornier as well, the Dornier Seastar is a twin-turbo centerline thrust aircraft flying boat, but that's still in the development phase. Other than that, there's not really many flying boats on the market, especially not the size of, the Albatross.
Yeah, there haven't been many made since the Albatross, and so I'm glad to see there's a resurgence in interest.
I guess, the reason why the Albatross and the Mallard were so popular back in the day was there wasn't many, just after World War II, there weren't many airports around, was there? So getting around and landing at the waterfront of, say, New York or, in the Bahamas was required because there was no runways. So it makes kind of sense that they're not being made anymore for that reason.
Our airplane obviously was a military aircraft, and so when its mission was over, so was it.
Yeah, exactly. I normally finish the question with some advice for some aspiring seaplane pilots, but it probably not really fitting it not being a commercial operator, but maybe have you guys got any advice for anyone who wants to go out there and purchase a warbird or military, ex-military aircraft to have as a private machine? What would you kind of suggest to them? Is it have a bulk load of cash that you're ready to get to lose, or
that's the obvious one, but yeah. But look, it's all about love and living life. When we bought the first Albatross, we knew it wasn't a smart thing, but we knew someday we'd be on our deathbed with tubes running out our nose and say, well, at least I owned an Albatross.
Yeah, exactly.
Not many people in the world who can say that. So if you find the warbird that turns you on, what's life for? Go for it.
Yeah.
It goes without saying, but you have to do a lot of research into that particular aircraft. And they all have a history to them, and it's not always good.
Yeah, I guess that's true as well. Great advice. And, I really appreciate you spending a bit of time, fellas. I'm sure that it's much better than sitting in the 40-degree heat in the back of the Albatross there doing some riveting work, no pun intended.
We're looking forward to getting back out there and getting back to the rivets.
I bet you are.
Yeah.
Cigar and scotch in hand again. And
that's
for this afternoon.
Right.
All right, Michael and Stuart, great to meet you both, and I really appreciated you coming on and talking all about your Albatross Zeus and coming and talking on the step.
Yeah, it's very nice, Dan. Thanks for the opportunity, and I look forward to coming down to Australia and seeing your operation.
Absolutely. More than welcome, both of you, any time, and come and check out the Mallard and come for a run.
Sounds great.
That's good.
Awesome, guys. All right, all the best, and good luck with the riveting.
Thanks, Dan. Adios.
And once again, that is the show for today, folks. I'm sure you love Michael and Stuart's story just as much as I did. What an epic private seaplane to own. I'm sure you'll agree with me there. And don't forget to leave me a review if you like the podcast and get in touch to say hello. As always, I love hearing from you all out there, that's for sure. Before we go, here is a little taste of next episode number 17 coming at you all the way from Seaplane Heaven in Alaska.
In this particular lake, it is surrounded by toes of glaciers, which is just the top side of ice. And it is very difficult to judge elevation because we don't have any reference of how high a particular ice wall is. But depending on where you approach a lake, a glassy landing onto a lake like that, as you're flying over a solid surface of ice, which you have no idea, then you're landing into a lake that's scattered and littered with floating icebergs. You see the tips of the icebergs, but it's surreal when you're on the water and you're floating next to these pieces of ice and building size ice blocks. It's spectacularly scenic. That's all I can say.
You don't know that voice, that is everybody's favorite GA seaplane photographer, Dion Mitten, who gives a very detailed understanding of what it's like to be a float pilot in Alaska. It's a great listen for sure. Really appreciate you all tuning in to the show and being on this journey, folks. But until next time, everyone, thanks for coming on The Step.